Good evening, listeners, to Time for an Awakening and the Black Talk Radio Network. The listeners of Our Story, featuring Bobby West Johnson and Brother Johnny live from New Orleans, will be preempted for 1 hour. So Time for an Awakening can broadcast, and the Black Talk Radio Network can broadcast the sounding, the alarm, the health effects of the Cuban oil blockade. This conference will be hosted by Roger A. Mitchell, Jr., MD, of the National Medical Association. He's the 126th president of the National Medical Association. It's the oldest black organization representing African-American doctors in the United States, established in 1895 in Atlanta, because black doctors wasn't allowed in the American Medical Association. So an organization representing black doctors was established in 1895 and still exists to the present. This conference will be hosted by the National Medical Association's president and the organization, with speakers Leonis Torres, the Cuban ambassador to the United States, L. Khadija K. Lang, M.D., is the National Medical Association's Region 6 chairperson. Dr. Abiku Dada of the International Medical Society, and was also trained as a doctor in Cuba. Dr. Chenzira Davis Kiani, the CEO of AS Speaks Consultant, she will be speaking. And Gregory Meeks, the New York 5th District U.S. Congressperson, will be speaking in reference to sounding the alarm, the health effects of the Cuban oil blockade. This broadcast will, and keep in mind that Our Story broadcast will start right after the press conference. This press conference is scheduled to be held between 7 and 8. Letting the listeners know to Our Story that the program will be preempted for this important press conference. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
Serves the constituents of New York's 5th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's a senior member of the House Financial Services Committee, where he served as chairman of the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection and Financial Institution, which oversees all financial regulators. He's very vocal on this issue surrounding Cuba and in surrounding the effects the Americans' policy is having on Cuba. So without further ado, I'll introduce Congressman Meeks, and then we'll join everyone else in the discussion. Congressman Meeks.
Let me thank you, Dr. Mitchell, and all of the work that you're doing. We're so proud of you as the president of the National Medical Association. And I thank you so much for inviting me to speak and for all of the work that you do here and, of course, at Howard University's hospital. And I know the work that y'all have been doing since 1895, when black physicians from the Jim Crow South were barred from joining the American Medical Association. And the founding members of your great organization of NMA did what history has so often required those of us who are excluded from power to do: build something of your own. And so I thank you so much. And you now focusing and trying to make sure that the attention is taking place with what's going on in Cuba. That's what brings us together tonight, and that's very important, and why I want to express my gratitude to the National Medical Association for shining a light on the humanitarian crisis in Cuba, which has been exacerbated by the Trump administration's oil embargo. Now, as we speak right now, hospitals in Cuba are struggling to stay open because of fuel shortages. And two of my colleagues, Congresswoman from Washington State, Congressman Jayapal, as well as Congressman Jonathan Jackson, just came back from Cuba. And what they described to me was very woeful. You know, it was a situation where doctors are being forced to make impossible decisions about who receives care. Patients with chronic illnesses are going without treatment. Families are navigating blackouts that disrupt everything from refrigeration of insulin to the operation of life-saving equipment. Now, I've traveled back and forth to Cuba for years, along with the members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And one of the things that Cuba has always been known for is healthcare and doctors. They've traveled around the world where people could not get healthcare, especially on the continent of Africa. They sent doctors there. In fact, I was at the table when we negotiated with Fidel Castro to have doctors trained in Cuba as long as they would come back to the communities here in America and serve folks. And for this administration to have such a policy that is taking place right now that is putting people in such dire straits is just inconceivable. And in talking to Brother Jackson and what he has seen on the ground, it is, you know, so horrific. So I started and I've been working with and well, I should say this, you know, for over 60 years, and it's except for a few years during the Obama administration, you know, the United States has adopted the same failed strategy of maximum pressure towards Cuba. The strategy relies on a cruel and forced logic. If the United States creates conditions to make the Cuban people suffer, that's what the strategy is for, intended to make the Cuban people suffer so that they believe that that will cause them to rise up to overthrow the Cuban government. This is something they've been trying to do for the last and over 60 years. It does not work. And it is a humanitarian, I think, devastation. So I am now in Congress. I'm the ranking member, as Dr. Mitchell talked about, and hopefully election's over, I'll be the chair again so we can keep this on the front burner. But I've begun to work in a bicameral together with Senator Tim Kaine to raise the alarms here on the Capitol of the humanitarian crises that the oil blockade has exacerbated, underscoring the fact that the people are dying and will continue to die if this course is not reversed. I'm working with Congresswoman Jayapal of Washington to introduce legislation that will prohibit tax dollars, U.S. tax dollars, from being used for the unauthorized use of military force in Cuba, because we hear and we've just heard today that there may be some planning to do something in Cuba very similar to what this administration had done in Venezuela. So, and look, I will admit we have some stark differences with the Cuban government on many issues, including political prisoners and human rights. But I firmly believe the best way to hash out our differences is through dialogue and diplomacy, not through ravaging a country's healthcare system or threatening military action. So the relationship between the governments of the United States and Cuba has always been complex. But the American people and the Cuban people have more in common than not, especially the African-American community. We always talk about, we look at what's taking place. We never look back what was happening in Cuba, especially for people of African descent before even the revolution with Fidel Castro. So what I'm hoping we can get out of this conversation today is a step in correcting course and having doctors that are on board now and listening, that we continue to drive up and draw the attention that's needed to this issue. It's my hope that we could move forward, move that needle forward, and finally make real change to bring a desperately needed relief to the Cuban people. Barack Obama was starting to do that. And Barack went to Cuba, and we were starting to reach a hand, and we were opening up the doors in that regard so that we could make sure that those people in the Cuban islands and it would have a better relationship and have access to medical utensils that's just 90 miles off the shore of the United States that would help them. But since the Obama administration, quite frankly, even included in the Biden administration, who continued to implement what Donald Trump started in his first administration, he never stopped it, he just extended it. The Cuban people are in desperate need right now. I'm looking at and may propose, you know, because I'm worried about an invasion, of which would just cause more devastation, and trying to make sure that we do the things to try to prevent that from happening. We have an uphill fight here in Congress because of, as we have always had, Florida politics in the United States of America. So I am hoping and looking forward to working with each and every one of you, and of course you, Brother Mitchell, so that we can keep ringing the bell and fight to change this archaic policy that we've had for 60 years, and to figure out how we can make sure that we can get some humanitarian aid down to Cuba as soon as possible. And it's going to take us to have our united voices, and voices like you, and voices like those of us from the Congressional Black Caucus, and that's and the members of Congress here. And that's why Jonathan Jackson was down. And I'm looking forward to getting down there myself and trying to figure out ways to do that so that we can make things better, and that the people of Cuba know that the government of the United States is not representative of those of us who are of African descent, and a lot of other Americans. And we then fight to make sure that people get a hand up, not a hand down, because we know, as Dr. King once said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So I hope you have a great dialogue, move forward. And Dr. Mitchell, let's reach out, let's work together, let's strategize together. I will keep you updated as to what we're doing here in Congress and how we can work collectively together in the plight of saving lives in Cuba. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman Meeks, for taking the time with us and your busy schedule. And we will, you have the commitment of the National Medical Association to work with you as we set the agenda and move things forward. Thank you so much. So in our next...
Also, I just see that the ambassador's on. I want to just recognize the ambassador, Torres Rivera. Thank you. And I want you to know you're not alone. We will be working with you. You always have friends from the Congressional Black Caucus. We've stood by you before. We will continue to stand by you. Thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing you.
So with that, I want to thank our ambassador to the U.S., Ambassador Torres Rivera. From 2015 to 2017, she was part of the Cuban delegation that met with the U.S. government authorities to discuss the reestablishment of diplomatic relations and the reopening of embassies in both countries. She was also part of the Cuba-U.S. Bilateral Commission and the Cuba-U.S. Bilateral Economic Dialogue, as other Cuba-U.S. Bilateral dialogues on regulatory issues, human rights, traffic in persons, and establishment of the direct postal services, renewable energy, and banking issues. In 2021, she was awarded with the Friendship Order from the State of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. She has many years of experience as she has served in international affairs. And so the question that she's here to answer is to really give us the state of affairs from her perspective and from the perspective of the Cuban people. The Honorable Ambassador Torres Rivera.
I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I would like to extend my gratitude to the National Medical Association, to its president, Dr. Roger Mitchell, to Congressman Meeks, and to all the panelists for contributing to this important discussion. We have just witnessed one of many testimonies of the tireless effort of Cuban doctors who stand alongside our people to defend health as a fundamental human right, even under extremely difficult conditions. These challenges that you have seen, that you have been talking about before, have been further intensified by recent measures aimed at restricting the flow of fuel to Cuba. What some people call a fuel blockade, it is in fact part of a broader unilateral, coercive, commercial and financial measures that have been in place in the case of Cuba for more than, for almost 70 years. We say that this system that has been imposed to Cuba has limited our ability to engage with partners around the world and generating shortages that affect the daily life of our people. This policy has tangible consequences. You were talking before, hospitals and clinics depend on stable electricity and reliable logistics, which are now under severe strain and is already disrupting life support system. While institutions rely on backup generators, those depend on fuel that is increasingly scarce in Cuba. Critical services such as neonatal care, dialysis, and chemotherapy are being also affected. Ambulance services face fuel challenges, shortages, delaying emergency response times, while the distribution of medicine is also increasingly constrained. As Dr. Mitchell was saying, the national surgical waiting list in Cuba has reached more than 96,000 patients, including more than 11,000 children, because due to emergency limitations, to energy limitations, non-urgent procedures are being postponed to prioritize the life-saving treatments. Highly sensitive programs are also under strain. For example, the maternal and child health program must ensure monitoring for 32,000 pregnant women that requires essential ultrasound and lab tests. Or, for example, 30,000 children in Cuba that needs vaccines at a certain time, and this process has been heavily affected by the refrigerated transportation chain. Or, for example, the 16,000 patients that depend on radiotherapy, or the almost 3,000 patients that need hemodialysis. Those are treatments that require stable and continuous energy, and we are facing problems with that. The situation also affects the medicine production. Our basic list of medicine includes 651 essential drugs. Yet, 69% have been affected, and 364 are currently unavailable. U.S. regulation prevents us for having access to advanced medical technology, for example, to medicines and equipment with more than 10% of U.S. components, forcing the country to seek alternatives at significantly higher cost. And yet, despite these challenges, Cuba continues to prioritize health. The country has made extraordinary efforts to build a free and universal health care system, achieving indicators comparable to developed countries. In conclusion, we can say that the strength and prestige of Cuban medicine are rooted in humanism and a profound sense of duty, values that have guided Cuban medical cooperation and Cuban medical personnel in 165 countries around the world. That same commitment sustains our health system today. But Cuba is not alone. And we are deeply grateful for the solidarity we receive from across the world, including the U.S. civil society, members of Congress, and organizations such as the National Medical Association, whose recent statement we deeply appreciate. Health is a fundamental human right and should never be impacted by governmental policies. What we are facing in Cuba today are not abstract challenges. They are real risk to human life and dignity. We will continue doing everything possible to protect our people's health while denouncing the human cost of these measures. And Cuba will continue being ready to engage with the U.S. government with respect to our sovereignty, our independence, and self-determination. Thank you for having me today here.
Thank you, Ambassador, for taking the time and your courage and your leadership in this space. We are excited that we have an opportunity at the NMA to work with you in helping to alleviate some of the pressures that are felt by patients and physicians there in Cuba. Next to talk to us is Dr. Chenzira Davis Kahina. Dr. Chen is and Ambassador Camisole sit on CARICOM's Reparation Commission Leadership Council, work together in the Caribbean Pan-African movement. She's also a past president of the Caribbean Studies Association, which is the hemisphere's largest body of professors who head Caribbean study departments at various universities. Dr. Chen also chairs the Culture Center at the University of the Virgin Islands. And so we will hear from Dr. Chen surrounding this oil blockade and its effects on CARICOM and the neighboring Caribbean. Dr. Chen.
Greetings, everyone. And I wish to just highlight how much I appreciate the opportunity to actually serve, definitely not as a replacement, because that's a little difficult, but to just share some reflections on behalf of His Excellency, Ambassador David Camisole, who serves as the ambassador to the Republic of Barbados to CARICOM. And he is currently in Geneva at the UN's Permanent Forum for People of African Descent, hence unable to join us in a live space at this particular time. I think it is very, very important to just highlight the particular areas of his areas of expertise in this regard, where he has always been a leading force, publishing, offering his international legal expertise, and for some, an activist in many, many respects when it comes to the humanitarian crises that are impacting Cuba, the energy crises that are affecting every single Caribbean nation, state, inclusive of the spaces from as far north in the Bahamas, as far south into Suriname. So he sent a particular reflection, and I want to just share that on his behalf. And it's actually entitled, "We Owe a Duty to Cuba." So it's very fitting to hear the Honorable Ambassador share the duty to Cuba. It's also very appreciative, Dr. Mitchell, to hear that the NMA is authentically engaged in the forefront of bringing this level of skill, talents, and expertise to ensure that the health rights of our brothers and sisters in Cuba are no longer in a state of unrest. All right. So with that, it is a message that was issued on the background of the president of the USA's radically intensifying their 64-year-old illegal blockade of Cuba by signing an executive order that imposes punitive U.S. tariffs on any country that dares to supply Cuba with oil. In a very dignified way, we've heard from several members of the Cuban community, but particularly there was a sister speaking to us about the elderly Cubans who are, quote, dying prematurely because the blockade prevents the arrival of medications for heart conditions, high blood pressure and diabetes, unquote. The newborn babies that are fighting for their lives because, quote, incubators in Cuba have had to be shut down due to a lack of fuel, unquote. And the, quote, terrorism through hunger, unquote, that is currently being inflicted on the Cuban people through a deliberate U.S. policy to deprive Cuba of food and energy supplies. Without a doubt, the current situation in our sister Caribbean nation of Cuba constitutes a severe humanitarian crisis that demands a significant and meaningful response from all people and governments of conscience. And in light of the special relationship that has existed between Cuba and the Caribbean community, CARICOM, over the past 53 years, it most definitely demands a response from the citizens and governments of CARICOM. So the reference I share, the most revered political leaders, Prime Ministers Eric Williams, Michael Manley, Forbes Burnham, and Errol Barrow, who in October 1972 took the courageous step of defying the mighty USA and the Organization of American States and broke the almost ironclad policy of isolation that these two entities had imposed on revolutionary Cuba. The electrifying message of these particular prime ministers delivered to the world back then, which is still relevant now, quote, the independent English-speaking Caribbean states.
I'm sorry, Dr. Chen.
Yes.
There seems to be something blocking your camera.
Oh, really?
Sorry. There you go. Thank you.
Better. Okay, thank my apologies. So my
sorry.
Apologies. Right, thank no problem. You. I think I wanted you to hear me more than see me, because I really want you to get the feeling of Ambassador David Comerstown with thank you. The exercising their sovereign right to enter into relations with any other sovereign state and pursuing their determination to seek regional solidarity and to achieve meaningful and comprehensive cooperation among all Caribbean countries will seek the early establishment of relations with Cuba. To this end, the independent English-speaking Caribbean states will act together on the basis of agreed principles, unquote. So this is the foundation of this establishment of this special relationship between Cuba and CARICOM, as evidenced by the establishment of embassies, then the exchange of ambassadors between Cuba and virtually every single independent CARICOM country, and by Cuba's extension of this range of invaluable services to the people, particularly through the lens of the medical brigades and the nations of CARICOM in the fields of medicine, education, sports, the arts, agriculture, disaster response, and the list goes on. So the time has come for us, the people and governments of CARICOM, to do our duty and to help our Cuban sisters and brothers to make it through this severe existential crisis. Cuba is desperately in need of food, medical supplies, and a range of other essential items, inclusive of solar energy heaters and other appliances to help mitigate the energy crises. Let us, governments and people together, make the effort to contribute significantly to Cuba in this time of extreme need. And what about the rest of the international community? Well, for some 33 years now, all of the major nations of the world, with the exceptions of the USA and Israel, have been voting in the United Nations General Assembly in favor of an annual resolution entitled Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Embargo Imposed by the United States of America Against Cuba. In the year 2024, exactly 187 nations voted in favor of the resolution. Dot, dot, dot. I want to, in the interest of time, I just want to be able to highlight those reflections that come from the His Excellency Ambassador David Comerstown of the Republic of Barbados. And I want to share the final point that he highlighted as it relates to how we're sounding the alarm in regard to exactly the theme that's being discussed tonight, these health effects of the Cuban oil blockade, but most importantly, what are the actionable deliverables of how we move this needle forward? And what are the things that are most crucial for us to bring into this particular solution-driven engagement? So Cuba, quote, is now the immediate target, but beyond Cuba is the entire edifice of multilateralism and international law, as represented by the United Nations organization, that produced some 33 successive resolutions condemning the U.S. embargo as illegal and demanding its termination. We all owe a duty to Cuba. Let us ensure that we live up to that duty, and by doing so, we might just find that we would have taken a critical step to preserve the order and safety of the entire human family. And I share that, again, with the focus being on us urging Caribbean action. This embargo impacts Cuba, but it impacts all of our relationships within CARICOM nations and just the Caribbean region in general, because it's impacting our health, it's impacting our human rights, it's impacting our access to food and other agricultural-based resources. It's impacting the quality of life. It's impacting the sustainability of any form of utilities. Persons are experiencing power outages throughout the region just because of these particular limitations of what's impacting Cuba, which impacts the entire Caribbean. Right. So we just would like to make sure that the solidarity that has been shared, the support for our brothers and sisters in Cuba is of a high importance. And we really hope that the hashtag of Let Cuba Live is more than a hashtag, that we're actually working together as cooperatively, as collaboratively as is possible to bring this particular effort into its forefront in the most positive way. So again, my reflections are not of the organizations that I may work for, but these are reflections on We Owe a Duty to Cuba, which the entire statement is available on almost every social media piece as presented by His Excellency Ambassador David Kamisyang, and I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Chen, for those reflections, and thank you to the Honorable Ambassador Kamisyang for him sending those words forward and allowing us to understand how important the work is that's happening in Cuba and how it affects the rest of CARICOM. Now we have an opportunity to hear from a fellow colleague who has trained in ELAM in Cuba. Dr. Abiku Dada is an internal medicine physician and global health leader committed to advancing prevention, health promotion, and community-based care in underserved population. Born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, he earned his medical degree from the Latin American School of Medicine in Havana, Cuba, and completed his residency at Morehouse School of Medicine. So without further ado, Dr. Dada is going to give us an idea of how this oil embargo and blockade, how that is, it tends to affect the education of our future physicians. Dr. Donna.
Thank you. Thank you, distinguished embajadora, distinguida embajadora, NMA. Thank you all so much. To our colleagues here in the conference, I want to thank everyone for this opportunity. But why Cuba? We ask why Cuba? Is it because Cuba helped in the Chernobyl explosion in Ukraine? Is it because Cuba sent doctors all over the world to more than 60 countries in the world? Is it because Cuba had an Operation Miracle where they operated on millions of people and cured blind and cured different causes of blindness? Is it because Cuba converted a military compound in Havana to a school called the Latin American School of Medicine that produced doctors like myself? Could it be? ELAM is the Latin American School of Medicine, has produced more than 33,000 doctors. I witnessed Elam grow from 45 countries to almost 120 countries within 2 years of me being an Elam. Today, I have the pleasure of being a Cuban-trained doctor who trained at the Latin American School of Medicine, who learned how to take the medicine to the community, to knock on people's doors and do what we call pesquisaje. And really canvas communities. And we really learn what it means that one drop of prevention is valuable. And so we learned a lot. I got a chance to learn different languages. I left Cuba with multiple languages in my pocket, including Spanish, of course, to the point where I think I speak Spanish better than I speak English today. But why Cuba? Today I sit on the board of the official alumni association, which is Sociedad Médica Internacional of Elam, which is translated the International Medical Society for the Latin American School of Medicine. So, and I'm representing more than 33,000 doctors from all over the world. And we have continued to make sure that we know that to spread the word that, hey, Cuba's not sending bombs all over the world. They're training doctors and sending doctors all over the world. And they trained doctors just like me. And we will continue to replicate that Cuban model. For example, last year, a group of 76 students and doctors went to Guinea-Bissau, to a community that the government says that they don't have access to. And I actually led and directed this brigade to go to Guinea-Bissau, and we basically we did a replica of what the Cuban model too is. We knocked on doors. We found the actual endemic, a typhoid fever endemic, and we really brought the health to the community. So this is what Cuba is producing all over the world, and we are grateful for what Cuba has done. I also sit as a member of the United States Alumni Association. I know you all may have heard, but Cuba has produced more than 200 U.S. citizen doctors who's graduated and they come back to the United States and are working in different hospitals in New York, in California, in Georgia, where I am today, and are studying and practicing medicine and specializing without any debt on their back. And they're able to focus on decreasing health disparities, achieving health equity without the burden of the debt of training to be a doctor. I won't talk too much. I know it's a time limit, but my closing remarks is, how can we continue to help Cuba? Cuba is in need. We know that cardiopathy patient, they all need aspirin. Maybe we can send some aspirin to Cuba. Maybe we can send some Tylenol to Cuba because of the chikungunya outbreaks or these different outbreaks that are going on. Maybe we can send some different things. There are different organizations that are doing different things, including the International Medical Society and the U.S. graduates. There's a lot of things you can do. And lastly, although Cuba is in this 60-plus years of blockade, they continue to offer full scholarships to U.S. citizens to come down to Cuba to study medicine. And that's really a way that we, you know, one way that we can not only become doctors, but I think it's an opportunity to help. I think it's an opportunity to really shine light on Cuba and what they're doing. So I really want to thank everyone for this opportunity today. Thank you all for this opportunity. Thank you.
Dr. Gada, thank you for taking the time and showing how important the medical education that our physicians are getting in Cuba and the work that you're doing internationally. I think it's important for us to realize that this oil blockade affects more than just the Cuban people. If that wasn't enough for you that the Cuban people are suffering, there are patients in America, in urban centers throughout the country, that are not wouldn't get care if there wasn't for Cuban physicians that are American that go and learn and come back. And we hear that we're talking about countries all over the world that send their young people to get trained in Cuba. Cuba is a gem when it comes to healthcare delivery for our communities and communities all over the world. And so I believe that Dr. Lang is here and our last speaker for this evening. And Dr. Lang is the chair of Region 6, which is most of our West Coast states. She's the CEO and medical director of Lang Family Practice, which she's been serving in South Central LA since she founded it in 1989, providing culturally competent, respectful, and full-scope family medicine with OB competencies. She's currently, works with Region 6 and is chairing our Region 6, but was in part of one of the original deployments to Cuba. And she sits on our Council for International Affairs. So I wanted to have her join us to talk a little bit about the importance of our international work and where Cuba fits in. Dr. Lang.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you, Dr. Mitchell, for convening this meeting on such a crucial topic and for including the Council on International Affairs of the NMA on the panel. Our chair, Dr. Eleanor Lisbon, sends her greetings, and we wish to convey that the NMA Council on International Affairs support of the NMA leadership in expressing our deep concern regarding the escalating health consequences of the ongoing Cuban oil embargo. Our council is committed to supporting the Cuban medical community and giving back to this important body of dedicated physicians and colleagues, as well as other healthcare providers. We're committed to the Cuban physician professional development, and it is part of our mission to elevate their clinical training whenever possible. We're also committed to supporting the networking opportunities at our national meetings for young Cuban physicians as they seek postgraduate training, as well as physicians who are already in practice in Cuba or other places. We're especially supportive of the Cuban Student National Medical Association, and we support current and future underrepresented minority medical students, addressing the needs of underserved communities and increasing the number of clinically excellent, culturally competent, and socially conscious physicians. And we're committed to elevating the injustice of the current political censure that is using the medical supply chain. To that end, through the NMA, we have sent representatives in the past to Cuba, and they have interacted with ELAM and the administration there. We have hosted ELAM graduates and students to address our House of Delegates during annual conventions so that more physicians here can be aware of their existence and their situation And the Council on International Affairs specifically have passed a resolution in our House of Delegates to ask NMA physicians to support ELAM and to and their grads upon their return to the United States, as well as requesting those of our colleagues who are able to host ELAM students for rotations here in the United States as a part of their education. My perspective as a physician in the U.S. who is doing obstetrics in America and witnessing the ridiculous and criminal maternal mortality rates that we are experiencing for Black women here is heartbreaking when I see a country like Cuba, who has done so well in controlling maternal mortality, have an increase of 50% in their maternal mortality rate as a result of this oil embargo. Women there are not even able to get ultrasounds so they can detect congenital problems and get early indications of things going on so that pregnancies can be properly treated and infants who have committed no crime can have a healthy start in life. As a mother, it hurts me to think that there are children, 11,000 plus, waiting for surgery in a country that would be able to do it if they had the energy supplies to operate and move forward. As a family member of victims of cancer who have undergone oncological surgery, it is personally devastating to know they've got over 5,000 cancer patients waiting for surgery and unable to be able to participate in that surgery and give themselves life-saving opportunities. And I have to say, as the director of Medical Bridge of the Motherland, we have taken groups of NMA physicians to Africa and to the Caribbean. I have worked directly in the operating room with Cuban physicians in Mozambique who have come from Cuba to Mozambique to work and provide service in areas that don't have providers. And they're providing excellent service. I've worked and seen this firsthand knowledge. And I have worked with them in medical missions in Grenada. And they are sending these physicians to work in countries that don't have enough physicians of their own and help elevate the medical care available to those populations. And I think for us as a nation to intentionally prevent this type of work from being able to continue, it's unethical, it's unprofessional, it goes against everything in our Hippocratic Oath that we have all taken, and we must stand together and bring this to an end and allow the people of Cuba, the physicians of Cuba, to have access to the energy they need to run their lives and to protect the patients over there, because every human being is a child of God. And we are all supposed to be looking out for our brothers and sisters. Thank you, Dr. Mitchell, for an opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Lang.
Thank you, Dr. Lang.
And we'll end here in this statement that the National Medical Association, representing the collective voice of Black physicians and the patients we serve, expressed deep concern regarding the escalating health consequences of the ongoing Cuban blockade. Cuba's healthcare system is currently experiencing severe strain driven by an intensifying energy crisis linked to restrictions on fuel access. Hospitals and clinics are facing persistent power outages, disrupting life-saving services such as neonatal care, dialysis, chemotherapy, and surgical procedure. As you heard before, more than 96,000 patients are currently awaiting surgeries, including 11,000 plus children, as the system is forced to delay care due to limited operational capacity. Fuel shortages are also impairing ambulance services, the transportation of healthcare workers, and the distribution of essential medicines. national pharmaceutical production has slowed significantly, and the stability required to store vaccines and critical medications is increasingly at risk due to ongoing electricity disruptions. The consequences are particularly alarming for vulnerable populations. Shortages of antibiotics, nutritional supplements, and basic medical supplies are contributing to worsening maternal and infant health outcomes, including tens of thousands of children experiencing delays in routine vaccinations due to logistical and energy constraints. From a medical and ethical standpoint, these conditions raise urgent concern. Access to reliable electricity, essential medicines, and functioning healthcare infrastructures are the foundational to modern medicine. When these are compromised, the result is preventable suffering, delayed care, and increased risk of morbidity and mortality. So the NMA affirms that health is a human right. Public health systems must be protected from policies that unintentionally or disproportionately harm civilian populations, particularly children, pregnant women, the elderly, and those of chronic or life-threatening conditions. As physicians committed to health equity and global health justice, we call for immediate removal of elements of the blockade that have led to the humanitarian and health impacts affecting the people of Cuba. We further encourage a dialogue, transparency, and collaboration among the global medical and public health communities in response to the crisis to assist with access to care, medical supplies, and life-sustaining resources needed post-blockade. The NMA stands in solidarity with healthcare professionals working under constrained conditions and reiterates its commitment to advocating for policies that protect patients' care, preserve human dignity, and uphold the fundamental principles of public health. I want to thank Congressman Gregory Meeks, the Honorable Most Excellent Ambassador Torres Rivera, Dr. Chen Davis Kahina, Dr. Abuku Dada, and Dr. Khadija Lang for your participating in this webinar. Our call to action is that this is just the beginning of a discussion. Join us in how we can do more to bring care to Cuba. The National Medical Association is working to see if we can't send a delegation to Cuba. We'll work with Congressman Meeks and others to see if we, as well as the ambassador to the U.S. From Cuba, to see how we can gain access, gain entry, speak to physicians, speak to patients, and understand the need for our support. I want to thank you all for taking the time. I know that there may be questions in the live aspect. Please put your questions, put your contact us, and join the movement. Because this movement to support Cuba is a movement to support even our patients here in America. There's no difference. And so when there is injustice anywhere, there's injustice everywhere. So thank you again on behalf of the National Medical Association and all of the members. Thank you for joining this webinar. And I hope that this alarm has sounded and you're inspired to move. Thank you to the production team, Rolf and his work,